Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
This is Radio Boston. I'm Anthony Brooks.
And I'm Meghna Chakrabarty. We're going to begin today with a look at a Massachusetts case that has made its way all the way to the United States Supreme Court. On Wednesday, justices will hear McCullen versus Coakley, a case that challenges a 2007 Massachusetts law requiring a 35-foot buffer zone around abortion clinics.
Anti-abortion protesters say the law inhibits their right to free speech and that public sidewalks have historically been the most common forum for public debate. But supporters of the buffer zone say the law protects patients and prevents protesters from harassing them. They say such protections are prudent and necessary. Now, part of the context here includes the deadly 1994 attack by John Salvi, who walked into two Brookline Planned Parenthood clinics with a rifle and opened fire, killing two people and wounding five others.
In a moment, we'll hear from Attorney General Martha Coakley and her argument in favor of the buffer zones. But first, let's turn to Philip Moran, a Salem-based lawyer and one of the four attorneys representing the plaintiffs in the buffer zone Supreme Court case. Philip Moran, welcome to the program.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
So first of all, tell me, lay it out as simply and as briefly as you can. What do you think is your single most potent argument for why you want the 35-foot zone eliminated?
Because, as someone just said, the public sidewalks have historically been a place where viewpoints are exchanged throughout America and since the beginning of the American colonies. And this particular bill is a violation of the First Amendment right to free speech within that 35-foot buffer zone.
Now, I've seen repeatedly that people who want the zone eliminated say that they can't talk to people entering the clinics within that zone, and they have to yell sometimes or use bullhorns in order to be heard. But I wonder, what is so special about that last 35 feet? Because protesters literally have hundreds of feet of sidewalk on either side of a clinic to approach people who are coming in to these medical facilities. Isn't that enough?
No, actually, if you were to look at the facilities themselves, you don't have hundreds of feet. Many of the people are dropped off right at the curbing and the buffer zone, for example, in the Brookline Clinic, goes actually out into the street so that the protesters, in many cases, have to stand on the other side of the street. So it goes beyond that. In Worcester and Springfield, because they're in office parks or office buildings, the distance is even greater. It's in Worcester, it's over 100 feet, and in Springfield, it's approximately the same distance.
Okay, but I guess what I'm wondering is, for example, I've read that even the plaintiff whose name is on the case, Eleanor McCullen, she says that despite the zone, she's been able to persuade more than 80 women not to have abortions. So she's obviously not completely prohibited from achieving her goals. She's been achieving her goals.
She has, but she also will tell you that on at least every day she protests, there are at least five or six people that she's unable to speak to, and she adds that up to about 400 potential clients a year that she could have spoken to, and that's why she did. Jean Zarella, who's another plaintiff, also who indicated that with the prior law was very successful, has not had one single save, what they call a save, since this 2007 bill went into effect.
Hmm. Now, you and your legal team are arguing, as you mentioned, that the buffer zone is in violation of protesters' First Amendment rights. But in its ruling against your clients, the U.S. First Circuit Court of Appeals said that the First Amendment does not guarantee a, quote, attentive audience or even one that's available at close range. What do you make of that?
Well, that's one of the reasons we went to the Supreme Court, and we believe that the Supreme Court granted certiorari, because I think the cases that the Supreme Court has come down with on the First Amendment disagree with the First Circuit Court of Appeals decision.
But in cases regarding buffer zones around abortion clinics, the court seems to have fairly consistently found in favor of the zones. I'm looking at Supreme Court cases from 1994, Madsen versus Women's Health Center, upheld a 36-foot buffer zone in the state of Florida, saying it does not infringe on First Amendment rights. 1997, Schenck versus Pro-Choice Network of Western New York, upheld a fixed buffer zone, especially in this case, where demonstrators' previous behavior had been questionable. And then, of course, in 2000, Hill versus Colorado, where a floating buffer zone was even upheld. What makes you think that the court might change its view based on, despite the precedents I just named?
Well, in Madsen and Schenck, in both of those cases, the New York case and a Florida case, the people who the law was applied against had actually had restraining orders because of somewhat abusive behavior, and that was why they put those in. Our people have never been, there's nothing to suggest that they're abusive. They're peaceful. Most of them are middle-aged and elderly women who simply want to be able to look eye-to-eye at the women going into the abortion clinic. Hill versus Colorado that you mentioned is a very important case and one that we feel that is going to be very important in this decision. Certainly the First Circuit Court of Appeals and the District Court here in Massachusetts relied on that. But in that, there are several differences. For example, in Hill, it applies to all medical facilities. In the Massachusetts law, it only applies to abortion clinics. In Hill, Hill case, there was everybody was excluded from speaking to the potential abortion woman going in for an abortion. Here in Massachusetts, the clinic employees and agents are exempted. So, for example, Eleanor McCullen, that you mentioned, or Jean Zarella, are unable to speak to anybody, even if the woman consents to be spoken to, inside that 35-foot buffer zone, whereas the clinic employees and agents have a perfect right to say anything they want. So we feel that that's viewpoint discrimination. And the government can't put a law into effect that favors one speaker over another. That's we believe, is one of the critical violations of the First Amendment.
Philip Moran, let me ask you. As you well know, similar buffer zones exist in various parts of the country, in places that actually have nothing to do with abortion, voting or polling locations, funerals. I mean, as people have noted, even the steps of the Supreme Court itself. So I guess what I'm wondering is that defining a physical distance between protesters and certain facilities is legal, because I guess there's this idea that Americans see certain things that we do, whether it's vote or mourn the loss of a loved one, are highly sensitive and should be free of the pressures of protesters. Why shouldn't medical treatment, specifically for women, you know, seeking the highly sensitive treatment of abortion, why shouldn't that be amongst those things?
Well, one of the reasons is that, for example, you mentioned the polling places, which I think the Attorney General often speaks about. In that case, whether you're a Republican, a Democrat, an Independent, a Communist, a Socialist, a Green Party, nobody can stand within a certain distance from the polling place to hand out leaflets or to speak to anybody. In this case, only people who are opposed or want to offer an alternative to an abortion are prevented from going inside that zone. The clinic, as I already indicated, the clinic employee or the clinic agent, the people who help guide them in, they're not prohibited from speaking. And so that's a major distinction in those cases versus our case. And we feel that that's really one of the smoking guns here.
Well, finally, I must ask you, I mean, the backdrop to this, as we mentioned in the introduction to our conversation, is that in 1994, John Selvey killed two people and wounded five other in two Brookline abortion clinics. I mean, at that time, at least, there was a very valid concern about public safety. I mean, I understand your clients have never been anywhere near or associated with anything like that. They are peaceful. But do you think that concern for public safety has disappeared now?
That particular was the reason they passed the 2000 legislation, which has been in effect for 7 years without an arrest or a conviction. And to be honest with you, John Selvey would have done what he did whether there was the 2000 law or the 2007 law. So I think that's an aberration, and it's a tragedy, and nobody would condone that. But whatever law was passed in that case would not have prevented him in his frame of mind from doing what he did.
Well, Philip Moran is a Salem-based lawyer and one of the team of attorneys representing protesters in the buffer zone case that will soon appear before the Supreme Court. Philip Moran, thank you so much.
Thank you. It's a pleasure being with you.
Now, let's hear the other side of this debate. Earlier today, we sat down with Massachusetts Attorney General Martha Coakley, who defended the buffer zone law as balancing free speech rights with the need for public safety.
We've taken seriously our obligation to balance the rights of those who want access to and have constitutional right to access a reproductive health facility. And by the way, it's men, women, all ages going in for a variety of health concerns, with the appropriate challenge and, frankly, obligation that we have to provide public safety in the instance, with the rights of those who have a right to protest and to be heard, but not to assault, interfere with other people's rights. And we have worked hard here in Massachusetts with the history of violence in the past, of interruptive behavior. And frankly, this has worked very well since 2007. Nothing has changed. The law and the precedents are the same. Our success with this has remained the same. And so we would urge the court to uphold that principle that the balance here is appropriate and constitutional.
Well, let me throw a couple of the arguments presented by those who are opposed to the law. They say that it infringes on the free speech rights of peaceful demonstrators. Yes, there have been cases of people being harassed as they approach. Of course, we've had cases of serious violence in this state. But this law casts a wide net and presumes that everyone is going to harass. So it infringes on the free speech rights of even peaceful demonstrators.
Look, we do this with voting booths. We do this with political conventions. We set up very clear. Everybody knows what the rules are. And it is that accommodation of the rights of those people who have a right to speak, balanced with those who have a right to access. This is not really so much about free speech. Is it about the history and the prior behavior, as well as all the competing interests here that I think this statute balances very well?
Mm. Again, opponents will say that this law is really concerned, they're primarily concerned about how selectively this law is applied. The idea that the sidewalk can be closed to the exercise of free speech only to a specific group of people. So, for example, they'll say Eleanor McCullen, one of the plaintiffs, can go to jail for saying, good morning, can I offer you some information about alternatives? Whereas someone from one of the Planned Parenthood clinics can say, good morning, may I help you into the clinic, and not end up going to jail. So they're concerned about a sort of selectivity here.
But the difference here is that that ability for a staffer to access or to help somebody get in or out is not about content of speech or ideas. It is really about assistance. And that is precisely what this statute does. It is content neutral.
We spoke to an opponent of this law earlier today, and he brings up this example. What about the case of a woman heading to an abortion clinic who might appreciate a chance to hear about alternatives? And opponents of this law would say that if she wants to stop on the sidewalk and get information about alternatives to abortion, that this law really makes that very difficult, if not impossible, for her.
But that has turned the argument on its head. In other words, now the issue is, what is the right of people who have a position that they would like to convey? And they can be seen, they can be heard, but we're balancing the rights of other individuals.
Is it necessary? And by that I mean, aren't there other laws on the books that provide law enforcement the means, the tools necessary to essentially go after people who are physically obstructing or stopping someone from their right to go into a clinic?
Well, but then you're saying that police around the clock have to be prepared to make arrests and book. And, you know, that is not what the First Amendment protection has ever required historically. Keeping the peace, setting up clear guidelines so that people know what rules to follow and where they follow is the preferred way of making sure that those rights are accommodated and balanced. And again, that's what this statute does.
Mm. You said at the beginning that this law has worked very well since the legislature passed it and it was signed into law in 2007. What's the evidence of that? I mean, do you hear from abortion providers that the buffer zone law has helped, has dialed down the tension? What's the evidence that it has worked?
Well, certainly the orderly progress of people in and out, and I think that this is material that the court has heard and can hear. If you want to look historically about what gets balanced here, you could start from the premise that everybody going into a health clinic has some rights to access that, to do it privately, unharassed. So this can't just be about, you know, the protester-centric, I need to get my message out. We understand that they have that right. Massachusetts protects that right. There are other competing interests here. And those of what I think have been balanced, and that's what I mean when I say it's worked, we have accomplished the balance of all those interests.
Let me ask you finally just about how the makeup of the Supreme Court has changed since 2000, a key year, because there was a Colorado law that was considered by the Supreme Court. All three justices who dissented in that Colorado case, Clarence Thomas, Scalia, and Anthony Kennedy, they're still there. Four of the justices who agreed with that law with the majority have been replaced. So arguably the court is a lot more conservative than then. Does that worry you? Are you concerned that this might not stand up?
Well, I would like to believe that this court will look closely at this law and the facts involved here. Surely just because their own beliefs have changed shouldn't indicate that there's a change in the law or that this Massachusetts statute is somehow now not constitutional when it has deemed to be historically in the past.
Yeah. We are talking about a Massachusetts law, but obviously folks all across the nation are watching this case with great interest. What's the sort of broad statement about the important principle that is at stake here, in your view?
There are two. One is that American life and our life in the courts is always about balancing interests and making sure that at an operational level, we are always careful to protect somebody's rights in a criminal court, that we protect First Amendment rights. The Supreme Court obviously plays a huge role in telling us how we do that. But in this instance, I feel we have done it extremely well, and that the court, when they look closely at our history, what we've tried to do to balance those rights, should, and I hope they will, find that this statute is constitutional.
All right. Well, Attorney General Martha Coakley, thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you.
The U.S. Supreme Court will hear oral arguments in the case of McCullen versus Coakley this Wednesday. And Wednesday on Morning Edition, you can also hear from Liam Lowney, whose 25-year-old sister Shannon was killed at a Brookline Planned Parenthood clinic in 1994. That's Wednesday morning right here on WBUR and WBUR.org.
Well, stay with us because up next, MBTA General Manager Beverly Scott is with us to talk about what needs fixing in the future of public transportation in Massachusetts. I'm Meghna Chakrabarty.
And I'm Anthony Brooks. This is Radio Boston. Thank you.